Happy Friday to you, and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review, where we discuss, debate, and in the process, hopefully make some sense of the recent news. Bill Radke has today off. I'm C.R. Douglas with Q13 News, sitting in for him this hour. Now, this week, the Seattle City Council made national headlines with a big vote to impose an income tax, a city income tax, on high earners. Seattle lawmakers argue the money is needed and that it will be an important step to reduce inequality. Now, the pushback could be heard far and wide, including on the national Fox Business Channel. Here's how one of their hosts described the state of Seattle.
Seattle used to be one of the most beautiful and livable cities in the world, but it has devolved into a socialist hellhole besieged by violence and economic immobility.
Okay, colorful language, no doubt, but there is more. More coming from this Fox Business Channel host.
The do-gooder authoritarians on Seattle City Council want the once robust Emerald City to swirl down the collective commode by enacting punishing minimum wage laws, a gun tax, and now a new tax on the wealthy that may not even be legal.
So there you have it, some reaction from the Nationals about the Seattle City Council imposing an income tax. Here in our studio today, Dave Ross with Cairo Radio. Dave,
hi, CR.
Should Seattleites take some pride in being mocked like this, or is there something to this new...
Well, Kennedy used to live here, so
I guess she feels
entitled, but she definitely hasn't been here in a while. Seattle is far from a hellhole. It is more vigorous than New York City in terms of the number of cranes and new buildings being put up. I think it's a vigorous city. I love the art scene. I love living here. Is the income tax a good idea or not? Will it even ever be implemented? I don't know. The evidence on the minimum wage is definitely mixed. The study that came out said it may not actually enhance the overall incomes of the demographic it's going after. Full disclosure, after my foray into politics, I served on the board of the Economic Opportunity Institute for about 10 years, which came up with the income tax thing. And my concern in the discussions that we had was that it ought to be offset by a similar decrease in the taxes that are considered regressive, since the whole point is to create economic fairness, since the lower income demographics are taxed at a much higher rate than the higher ones. Then if you're going to really make the case for this in a bipartisan way, it should be linked to a cut in those regressive taxes. As far as I know, this measure does not guarantee that.
They talk about it,
but it's not part of the law.
Yeah. The idea has been tossed around by the left for a lot of years in Seattle, this income tax idea, never really getting close to reality until now. Now, here are the numbers. The plan would impose a 2.25% tax on incomes above $250,000 a year for an individual and $500,000 a year for couples. So it won't affect most people, just high earners, raising about $140 million a year used for social services and other city priorities, say advocates. Now, Tina Podlodowski, you're here at our table as well, chair of the Washington State Democratic Party. You used to be on that Seattle City Council back in the 90s when something like this, it seems to me, would never have seen the light of day. How did this idea go from being fringe to fruition in not that long a time?
Well, I think it was because of the GOP-led state Senate sort of sticking it to the poor and the middle class in the last budget here in Washington State. I mean, the reality is the poor in our state pay 7 times more than the rich in taxes in terms of percentage of income. And I think what the Seattle City Council is trying to do here is open up a discussion statewide. We have so many different taxing sources, and we're not talking about them in aggregate to figure out what makes a fair as opposed to a regressive tax system. So property tax, sales tax, B&O tax, income tax, capital gains tax, carbon taxes, and the myriad of tax breaks that we have for businesses in the state of Washington. All of those need to be on the table as part of the discussion. So kudos to the Seattle City Council for putting this on the table. Let's see how far the discussion gets.
Now, your counterpart, the head of the Washington State Republican Party, Susan Hutchison, she strongly denounced this plan at City Hall. She was there right after the vote was taking, urging resistance even, but she was clearly in enemy territory. Let's listen.
We are encouraging all the citizens of the city as well as the state to exercise civil disobedience, to not comply, to not file, and to not pay.
Okay, urging resistance there is people trying to drown her out with a tax the rich chant. Paul Guppy, let's bring you in. You are our final voice at the table. You're with the conservative think tank, the Washington Policy Center. You know, the fear expressed by many in the GOP is, watch out, because this is the kind of virus that could spread to other cities and maybe eventually get a foothold statewide. Is that part of your worry?
Yes, I think that's a natural direction that this tax would go. First, I have to respond to national critics who are going after my hometown, Seattle, which is a great place to live, and I love living here. So I think that criticism is off base. I think it does reflect that kind of hot commentary that Seattle is becoming known as a laboratory for liberal ideas and where they're tested out. On the income tax itself, to pick up on Dave's point, I don't think this proposal promotes fairness because it doesn't do anything to reduce anybody's taxes. The regressive taxes that people in the city are paying now, really high property tax, the highest sales tax in the city. So I think the proposal could have been more balanced and would have been more reasonable if they had said the revenue that comes in from an income tax, if it ever goes into effect, would be used to reduce regressive taxes on other people who live in the city. That at least would be a balance. But in answer to your direct question, yes, the problem with getting an income tax established is that it then gets extended to middle-class families. And that has happened in the federal tax and also in other states.
But also gets extended perhaps geographically. I mean, you could argue that happened with the minimum wage. I mean, the minimum wage kind of started in SeaTac, got a foothold, went to Seattle, went to Tacoma, and then kind of built momentum for a statewide increase. Dave, you mentioned the legality of it. Is this just going to be symbolic? There's pretty convincing evidence, it seems to me, that there's a provision in the state constitution that doesn't allow it. There's even state laws that don't. Can Seattle go rogue?
There's two things. There's a piece of legislation which specifically outlaws a tax on net income. They're going to argue, well, we're not talking net, we're talking gross income. And the constitutional provision, it's not written in the Constitution so much as embodied in a Supreme Court decision, which defines income as property. So the real and the proponents make no bones about this. The whole idea is to test this court decision and see if they can get it reversed, in which case, yes, they want it to go viral to other cities, if not just be adopted by the state legislature.
I don't think that's the case. I think, gentlemen, you are missing the point here in terms of the discussion around taxes. The GOP for, gosh, as long as I've been involved in politics, have been putting out this idea and this boogeyman, really, of a state income tax, while at the same time raising property taxes on the poor and the middle class in the state of Washington to the point where it's untenable and people cannot survive in their homes. It's adding to the housing affordability crisis because of it. So again, don't just look at this through the lens of the income tax. You have to look at this through the lens of, we need a real discussion on taxation here in Washington state, and we need all members to be at the table. And frankly, the right hasn't been there.
But if advocates are so worried about the regressive tax structure in the city of Seattle statewide also, why didn't they do a clear link in this legislation so that raise the income tax, yes, on the one hand, lower the sales tax, perhaps? I mean, this doesn't take away the regressive burden of any of the other taxes.
Because it's one lever to start this particular conversation. Look, in the city of Seattle, it's been really clear that people want to pay their fair share and folks want the opportunity to be able to pay in on these sorts of taxes as well. If you just look at the city of Seattle, remember back to 2010 when we had the initiative related to taxes on high income earners. Well, that passed in Seattle with 62% of the vote. So Seattle as a city is not immune to paying their fair share on different taxes and having these discussions. I think where folks are trying to draw the line and where the discussion is not happening where it needs to be, which is at the state legislature, is the regressive nature of relying on just property taxes and sales taxes for our state budget. So if the income tax is the wedge to open up the conversation on B&O tax, capital gains tax, carbon tax, tax breaks, have at it. I think it's a great discussion to have.
The problem I see, though, as somebody who agrees our tax system here is regressive, is that the people who would be helped by this don't vote for it statewide. In Seattle, maybe. But the people who you'd think would really want this did not vote in favor of that initiative. And that, I think, is a difficult thing, where you have Seattle think tankers seeking to tell other people what's good for them, and they seem to resent that.
No, I think it's just the fear-mongering that comes along with this. You heard Susan, in my counterpart, Susan Hutchison, in this clip, basically suggesting civil disobedience on the part of millionaires for not paying their fair share in taxes, which is ridiculous. You heard Paul just a minute ago basically saying, oh, yes, it all migrates to the middle. It's going to migrate down to poor people. And no, there's no evidence of that happening here in Washington
Wait
State.
Wait a second.
You know, it's not. There's no evidence of that here in Washington State. In fact, when Democrats had a supermajority in 2007 and 2008 in Washington State, they didn't pass an income tax on the middle class. So again, I think this is a specious argument.
So again, as a researcher, we just look at real world experience. And every state that has had enacted an income tax has expanded the tax to middle class and working class families over time. They have increased the rate. California's income tax now is 13%. But the one that we all have experience with is the federal tax, which literally did start out as a tax on the 1% back in the early 1900s when it started. And now the income tax is a major tax that working families pay. So it's completely reasonable to say that it would be expanded.
Okay, we move on. Coming up on the Week in Review, Donald Trump Jr., he's lawyering up after that, after admitting that during last year's campaign, he did, in fact, take a meeting with someone from Russia offering top secret goods to help with his father's presidential campaign. But first, the Seattle mayor's race. Three big endorsements go to three different candidates in that crowded contest. Ballots are dropping now. What's at stake for the city and region? Who's got the upper hand? It's the Week in Review. Back in a moment. Okay, back now with the Week in Review. I'm C.R. Douglas with Q13 News, in for Bill Radke, who is out today taking some R&R. It's a great pleasure to be joined by three distinguished yet different voices when it comes to politics here in the region. Tina Podlodowski is chair of the Washington State Democratic Party. Paul Guppy is the vice president of the conservative think tank, the Washington Policy Center. And finally, Dave Ross, a longtime voice on Cairo Radio. Now, the big media endorsements came out this week in the Seattle mayor's race. The Seattle Times, it threw its weight behind former federal prosecutor Jenny Durkan. The Stranger came out for urban planner Carrie Moon. And finally, the Seattle Weekly, they are now all in for activist attorney Nikita Oliver. So important boosts for all three of those candidates as the ballots arrive in the mail and voting begins. Here's why Carrie Moon says she is the right choice to be the next mayor.
Having an outsider who's skilled and a professional urban planner who really understands urban growth and urban development and how to get ahead of growth, how to have compact, equitable growth, I think we're crying for that in our city right now. We've had a lot of mayors who don't quite understand that, who play politics a different way, and I think people are ready for real solutions.
Dave Ross, Jenny Durkan, she gets the Times endorsement, clearly seen as the front runner. She's ranked highest in the polls. She's got the most money, probably the biggest endorsements when it comes to labor, business, etc. Is she as unbeatable as she looks, or is this race tighter than it seems?
Well, I've interviewed all these people, and they're all super confident. And Jenny Durkan, of course, is someone who can put you behind bars, is really, really super competent. She has said she wants to take on the nuts and bolts problems of the city. She's somebody who wants to take care of the potholes and put that above politics. And she certainly is a familiar, dare I say, centrist name, which I think has a lot of appeal to people. Nobody's going to say is going to be embarrassed by saying I voted for Jenny Durkan, 4 years from now.
Paul Guppy, how do you see this race?
Well, it's interesting from both as someone who lives in the city and then from a political science point of view, what has always struck me about Seattle's leadership is how often it turns over and how sort of difficult it is to get steady, almost kind of boring governance in City Hall without the drama, without constant changes. Jenny Durkan maybe represents that. Yeah. She's the only candidate I read about that did talk about these kind of nuts and bolts government services. But maybe that sends a message of kind of toning down the volatile politics of the city and producing just municipal government. And in addition to her resume and her association with President Obama, I think that gives her a leg up.
Tina Podlodowski, there seems to be six major candidates in this race, in addition to Durkan and Moon and Oliver, who I mentioned. There's Bob Hasegawa, Justin Farrell, and of course, former Mayor Mike McGinn, who's in. I could make a convincing case that any one of those has a path to get through the primary. I mean, they all come with kind of distinct, fervent bases that could get you 10 to 12 6%, that may be all you need to become one of the top two. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, I think with 21 candidates in the race, it's an incredibly small vote total to get you through in a top two primary. And take a look at what happened in the last race between Mike McGinn and Ed Murray. When they ran in their primary, less than 2,000 votes separated them from the top two slots. So in some ways, it's anybody's race. But I do really want to pause for a moment and let's hear it for the women in this race, right? For the first time in a long time, you mentioned three major media endorsements. And who are they for? Three women: Jenny Durkin, Carrie Moon, and Nikita Oliver. I wasn't alive the last time we had a woman really competing in the mayor's race.
They named the tunnel machine after her.
I know. And Bertha was a hot ticket, taking control of the city when she was actually head of the council and the mayor was out of town.
We should just, buffs, Bertha Knight Landis, 1928, mm-hmm. mayor of Seattle.
Exactly. For a hot minute.
So would you say hear it for the women for Susan Hutchinson, too, as the head of the Republican Party?
I think it's pretty awesome to have two women heading the two major political parties here in Washington State. I do think it's actually a phenomenon. I'm not quite sure if there's any other state happening in the country where that's happening right now. Susan and I should have a series of spirited debates, and I wish she was here to have one too. I am ready to go.
Yeah,
but
on KOW anytime.
Yeah,
we'll
but
take you both.
But CR, you're so right. I mean, it is really anybody's game, and I think it's the ground game that makes that happen in this race.
You know, one thing that comes up at all these forums is homelessness. It's increasing. We don't just see more of it. Literally, the numbers show it's up quite a bit. You have Durkin on the one hand taking a little bit of a tough love approach, saying she is for sweeping the camps. So less accommodating is kind of her message. I think you could read it that way. I think most of the others, certainly of the other top six, are more willing to accommodate, more willing to have those homeless camps, put more money. Do you think that, Dave, is going to be a big piece of this year? Accommodation versus compassion on the homeless issue?
We held a series of forums on homelessness where we talked to all parties. And Barb Poppy was there, the homeless consultant on all three of them. And there was a sense, and this was among people who I think it's fair to say are sympathetic to the problems of homelessness. They're not blaming the victims, but they are out of patience, especially the business people, with homeless camping on their doorsteps. People in neighborhoods are tired of the broken down RVs being parked there. And I think the city's moving in the right direction. They've taken Barb Poppy's advice. And I think you can make a moral case for once you've got the facilities, once you have alternative facilities that will take people into shelter unconditionally, you can then say, I'm sorry, camping is not an option in Seattle. We have a place for you to go. If you don't want to accept that, then you've broken the rules and you'll have to find someplace where we can't see you.
And the candidate most willing to say that, it seems to me, is Jenny Durkin.
I haven't done a rigorous study on everybody's views. I detect that everybody is sympathetic, but I think once you become the mayor of the city, you can't just rely on your own base to take up one of these policies. You're going to have to talk to the merchant class. You're going to have to talk to the neighborhoods.
Tina Podlodowski, will it be homelessness? Will it be transportation? Will it be taxation? What rises to the level of decisiveness in this election in your mind?
I think that this issue in terms of trying to resolve housing equity here in the city is the canary in the coal mine, and so indicative of the challenges that we face with a city that's growing at the rapid rate that Seattle is growing, unlike Kennedy seems to think. And it's not really about accommodation or compassion, but I think it's about action. People are looking for action in this case, and how do we get people rapidly rehoused? Dave spoke to that a little bit. At the cornerstone, I think, of delivering services and helping people is being able to have them have a home as that first spot and that first place. I think that's why organizations like Mary's Place has been so successful and been able to do that with women and children. And it's why places, for example, like Downtown Emergency Services Center, where they build housing for folks who are chronic alcoholics, who are not going to stop drinking, but who were consistently using a disproportionate amount of services because of health issues and other sorts of things. banks build housing for these folks, did not make the demand that they stop drinking, but could deliver them services. And the cost to the city and the cost to all of these services went down fairly dramatically by being able to give people rapid housing and work with those issues there. So I think whoever can solve this, whoever's got the plan to deliver action, is going to be the person who wins on this issue.
Paul, I hear another dynamic in this debate, and it goes to this affordability question and development question. And that is, are you harder or softer on developers? So the housing bargain we struck a few years ago under Mayor Murray has some new requirements for housing developers to create more affordable housing in their new buildings. Some want to increase that burden quite substantially, saying that developers need to shoulder more of this. Mm-hmm. There are some in the race who say if you put more burdens on developers, you will actually chill development and actually make the problem worse. Do you think this will come up in the race?
Sure. And I love this because this is my field, which is policy analysis. And the as a mechanism, the problem with, you know, slapping fees or requirements or additional taxes on developers, fine, the city can be, quote, tough on developers, but the developers don't care. They just pay the taxes. All they want to know is, how much do I have to pay to be in this market? Is property taxes or fees or permits or affordable housing assessments? They will just simply pencil it into the cost of the entire development and just add it to the price of housing that is paid someplace else. I think the best way to be toughest on developers is to provide them with more competition. So this is where the Growth Management Act over 25 years has played a role of eliminating the competition that would normally be happening in other areas outside the city.
Loosen the growth boundaries?
Or revisit it or adjust it in some way. Because if I'm a developer in Seattle and my normal market competition has been eliminated in the fringe areas, that leaves the housing market just for me. And if Seattle proposes additional fees that I have to pay for affordable housing or a certain number of units that have to be below market, that's just a government program. I comply, and the developer calculates that cost into the rest of the units.
And so if you loosen the growth boundaries, how does that play out?
Because now the Seattle-based developer faces competition someplace else, because the regional housing market has become looser, more supply is coming on board, and to attract renters and buyers in Seattle, the developer would have to compete with someone who's building someplace else. And it's just that started in the early 90s, and we're trying to preserve open space, which is good. But again, from an analysis point of view, I just see that constriction explains a lot of why housing in Seattle is so expensive.
Okay, we take a quick break. When we return, Donald Trump Jr., the Russia connection, just got a little closer this week. We've got that and more when our program continues in a moment. Okay, the Week in Review continues here on KUOW. My guest, Paul Guppy, the vice president of the conservative think tank and research group, the Washington Policy Center. Dave Ross, a longtime host on Cairo Radio. And finally, Tina Podlodowski, who is in the thick of things politically as the chair of the Washington State Democratic Party. And Bill Radke, well, he is in the thick of relaxing. He has today off. I'm C.R. Douglas with Q13 News. So the Russia plot thickens. This week, Donald Trump Jr. admitted that he indeed met with a Kremlin-connected attorney promising information damaging to Hillary Clinton. Now, the meeting was in June of last year, just as his father clinched the GOP nomination. Now, also attending was a D.C.-based Russian lobbyist, as well as Trump's then-campaign manager Paul Manafort and his son-in-law Jared Kushner. Now, both Trump Jr. and Trump Sr. downplayed the significance of that event this week.
In retrospect, I probably would have done things a little differently. Again, this is before the Russia mania. This is before they were building it up in the press. For me, this was opposition research. They had something, you know, maybe concrete evidence to all the stories I'd been hearing about, but they were probably underreported for, you know, years, not just during the campaign. So I think I wanted to hear it out.
I have a son who is a great young man. He's a fine person. He took a meeting with a lawyer from Russia. It lasted for a very short period, and nothing came of the meeting. And I think it's a meeting that most people in politics probably would have taken.
Now, the revelations this week don't amount to evidence of outright collusion between Russia and Trump to influence last year's election, but it does get a lot closer to anything we've seen up to now. And of course, the special prosecutor who's looking into that larger collusion question will no doubt be taking all this new information into account. Now, Tina Podlodowski, Donald Trump Jr.'s defense is that campaigns take opposition research wherever they can get it. You've been in campaigns. You now basically run a bunch of them as chair of the state Democratic Party. You guys want to hear opposition research wherever you can get it. Is that news?
Yeah, it's news because this is not opposition research. This is actually getting information from a foreign government. And any logical, right-thinking person would have gone immediately to the FBI as opposed to saying, I love it, and going out and getting this information. He knew in very explicit terms that this was information from the Russian government wanting to help his father to win elections. So it's beyond my capacity to think that anyone would think that this is an okay thing and not tantamount to running up to something terribly illegal as well as treasonous and making this happen. And one word about Russian mania. Okay, come on, you guys. You've been talking Russia on this campaign since the beginning of Trump, but Russia mania has been happening in this country since 1917 and the Russian Revolution. So none of this is new news.
Paul Guppy, how bad was the week for Donald Trump?
Well, in terms of optics, it looks bad because it's built on top of 9 or 8 months of speculation about Trump's supposed involvement with Russia. And I think on that, in terms of substance, I just think we need more facts. To me, there's irony that Trump is often accused of making assertions on Twitter without evidence. And then I watch the evening news, and there's speculation about Trump's connections with Russia, again, without evidence. So the more facts that come out, the better. I will say, from especially when I worked in Congress, that congressional staff meet with foreign representatives all the time. So do reporters. So do agency personnel in the government. To receive a call from someone who says, I want to meet with you to talk about a certain issue, or to tempt them about opposition research, is something that routinely happens in Washington, D.C. all the time. I certainly don't think it's treason. I think that's overblown. And then the other thing that's interesting is it seems like a classic bait and switch, which is the person says, I want to talk about a certain issue. You meet with them, and the issue turns out to be trying to remove sanctions from that Congress has put on Russia. So this was actually a lobbying meeting by this Russian lawyer who apparently has been hired to try to get sanctions against Russia repealed. Again, a typical issue that Congress would deal with all the time. So I think the risk is for Democrats, although I'll let Tina speak for herself, is just being overblown. That kind of crying wolf that every time there's a connection with Russia, here it is, the big conspiracy has been revealed, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of substance behind that. Now, we may find out more, which I think is what needs to be the next step.
Dave Ross, you've got a great political instinct. You've been a journalist for a long time, even a politician for a short time. Some things stick and some things don't.
Well, this is definitely stuck based on the Republican reaction. So they're worried about
meaning
this. They see this as a smoking gun, a little closer to something that's impeachable than they thought that this was ever going to get. I look at it and I see this is evidence of corporate behavior. Corporations just don't see borders. I think since they had done so much business with Russia for the Miss Universe pageant, meeting with somebody from Russia or from whatever country is like meeting somebody across the street to them. They're looking for business deals. And they're pretty smart people, I guess, in terms of their investments overall. And you don't make money by turning down prospects out of hand. So I think he took a risk here. He has been. His lawyer must have no hair left, because to release those emails was, you know, something that no lawyer would ever have allowed him to do. But the reason he did it, I think, among others, is that he sees nothing wrong with it. This is just him being curious and looking for a deal. And he doesn't care whether it comes from the Russian government or anyplace else.
He called it a wasted 20 minutes, which again kind of resonated with me, because I've been in thousands of meetings that were a complete waste of time. And that's how he described this one.
But that's where he doesn't see that the fundamental issue here, that there is something wrong with this, right? That even if you want to play this off as corporate behavior, colluding with the Russian government is not something that... To to be taken lightly. And it's the same deal when it comes to issues related to North Korea, issues related in any sorts of things. When we're talking about international action and international diplomacy, it's really clear the Trumps have no idea how to govern. And that extends to certainly the president on this issue. And I think all of his family members that he's brought in like a kind of a low rent mafia crew here.
It's interesting because their defense seems to be nothing came of the meeting. I mean, right. That's been talked about from Trump Jr. The president said that. But I guess the implication of that is the goods they were hoping for didn't
had
materialize.
The documents,
Had
the government documents purloined by the Russians, presumably stolen from the Democrats, materialized, then it wouldn't have been a waste of time.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what's got, I think, Republicans spooked because one of them said, just because you didn't receive the stolen goods, doesn't mean that by seeking them, you weren't trying to break the law.
Well, so that is a legal point. So apparently the law bars a campaign from receiving, quote, anything of value, which is usually interpreted to mean bribes or gifts or something like that. And so one legal question, especially if this case goes forward, if it becomes a case, would be for the courts to decide whether hearing information is the same as a, quote, thing of value. So that would be a change in the law that rather than receiving an envelope full of cash or a gift or something, if I receive information from a foreigner, is that run a person, an American citizen, afoul of treason laws and things like that?
And some of that receiving information, is that the release of all the DNC emails? Is that the release of the Hillary emails? I mean, where does that sort of end in the context?
But the other thing here is it's clear, and I've talked to several foreign policy experts about this, is that the Putin people targeted the Trump organization early on as very easy to hack into. I'm just not talking about computers now, but people who are inexperienced and were relying on a lot of outside experts that they didn't really know much about and saw this as an ideal opportunity to insert some of their own people into that inner circle if they possibly could. And it sounds to me like the Trump people were either naive or just willfully turning a blind eye to the possibility that once they got near power, they would be immediately targeted for espionage. And I think that's part of what's going on here.
I'd still like to see Donald Trump's tax returns to know how much money
Maybe the Russians have them.
That's the other thing. There's a reason he's not releasing them. It's got to be bad.
Exactly. And you look at all the times he's declared bankruptcy and the issues with his businesses. He wasn't getting money from the U.S. You know he was getting money out of Russian oligarchs there. So, yeah.
Okay, speaking of presidential politics, is our governor, Jay Inslee, actually a leading Democratic contender to take on Trump in 2020? Our panel weighs in just ahead. Okay, back now with the Week in Review here on KUOW. Three voices from across the spectrum join me today. Dave Ross of Cairo Radio, Tina Podlodowski, chair of the Washington State Democratic Party, and finally Paul Guppy, vice president of the conservative think tank, the Washington Policy Center. Bill Radke has the day off. I'm C.R. Douglas with Q13 News. Now, Governor Jay Inslee surprised many this week when he vetoed an item in the hard-bargained budget deal that Democrats and Republicans spent months crafting. Inslee struck the part that granted manufacturers across the state the same tax break that Boeing got a few years back to keep aerospace jobs in the state. Now, Inslee did push for that Boeing deal years ago, but argues that similar tax breaks for other manufacturers aren't justified now, especially when many working-class families will see property taxes go up in this budget. But Republicans, well, they cried foul over Inslee's action.
When you have a deal, you have a deal. And this is I've never seen a governor act in this way in my 18 years in the legislature.
They're wrong, and I can't control their tender feelings, but I can control what the state constitution says. And it says that the governor maintains, including in this bill, the right to veto bad provisions.
Okay, along with Governor Inslee, you just heard from State Senator Doug Erickson, a Republican up in Ferndale. Now, Tina Podlodowski, this was a line item veto of a larger budget deal. Deals like that, big deals, always involve all kinds of side trade-offs and little compromises and little midi deals to kind of make it all happen. And making it all happen in this case meant finally coming to this agreement to among other things, fully fund public schools, which is the Supreme Court mandate. So the argument Republicans are making is that for Inslee to take a piece of this deal and pull it is unfair because it basically spoils the whole agreement.
Well, as a mom of three, that sounds like the kind of thing my three-year-old might say. Give me, you know, it's mine, 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 give me this. I mean, the reality is that Republicans came to the table incredibly late on this deal, and the Democrats had to be the grown-ups in the room to make sure that government did not shut down, that the Washington state government did not shut down. This particular provision was a tax break that was slipped in the last 24 hours with no accountability, no proven job growth, and no sunset date for this particular review. So it's just incredible to me. It's incredibly backwards piece of taxation, and fully a quarter of it was tax breaks for big oil in Washington state. So do I think Governor Inslee should have vetoed this? Absolutely, especially when the Republicans built a budget based on property tax increases to the middle class and the poor in the state. Absolutely, go Governor Inslee.
Paul Guppy?
Well, I won't say that, but I will say...
I was hoping you might, Paul. No, yeah.
But I will say that the budget process is always, hopelessly mysterious and obscure. So what I just focus on as these ideas emerge from the legislature is the substance of the policy. Excuse me. And that's actually something that I like about this. And that is that in 2003, Governor Locke signed this aerospace tax break for Boeing and for other companies in that sector. And the argument always was, that's not fair. Why did they get a special break? And so what this bill was trying to do was to apply that regardless of the politics in Olympia. The result was that all manufacturers would get the same break. And that's obviously fair. It also had the advantage of reducing the cost of creating manufacturing jobs. And so I saw it mainly as a jobs bill. And it is frustrating, I'll say, to hear the governor talk about increasing property taxes, and the budget he signed includes a huge increase in property taxes, and then use that as a reason for vetoing a bill that cuts taxes on someone else.
So if he's concerned, there was no reason, because the GOP would do nothing but property tax increases in this particular budget. So somebody's got to be the grown up in the room and not shut down government, and if that's an issue.
So for the public, if the governor's concerned about increasing property taxes, then why not just provide tax relief straight up without connecting it with another issue?
And that, to me, that well, let's talk about the upshot, which is the Republicans say they're going to block the Capitol budget now, which would...
Another three-year-old behavior.
How big a deal will that be?
Tantrum.
Well, it stops school improvements, as I understand it. It stops things like community centers and other... it doesn't affect transportation, but it does stop things that are not related to this current issue.
I think our roads and some roads and bridges come out of the capital budget.
Yeah, and also projects like
transportation
projects like the projects like the Burke Museum that are just a couple blocks away from where we are right now. So look, I mean, it all comes back to the lack of willingness of the Senate GOP majority to really have a full discussion on taxation in this state and to hold the state budget hostage on the issue of property tax.
Now, the interesting thing is that the deal that included this tax break actually was supported by a huge majority in both houses, including tons of Democrats. Yeah. So they may have enough votes, even with Democrats, to override this. We'll see. The numbers are this. The cut amounts to, meaning this tax break amounts to, would, if it wasn't vetoed and if it's not overridden, $65 million a year over 4 years. Now, that seems like a big number, but pretty small in the scope of the 2-year budget of the state, which is $43 billion. Dave, we talk about the capital budget and the sort of, you know, now Republicans are going to kind of flex their muscle. Did this create such bad faith that it's going to be impossible to not just the capital budget, but all kinds of things?
Well, I talked to Doug Erickson, and he certainly is feeling pretty ticked off about this and made no bones about the idea that he thinks the capital budget ought to be blocked because of this. I tried to persuade him to withhold punishment until the next session, maybe, but he didn't seem moved. So it sounds like, and I know Dino Rossi was also pretty upset about this. I'd be interested to hear from Tina. Why did so many Democrats vote for it then?
Well, I think in the end, folks wanted to get a budget bill done, and many folks didn't even realize that this provision was actually in the bill.
Voted on, right? Yeah. It was voted on as a separate bill.
Right.
There was a separate roll call vote on it.
Right. But for many folks, they wanted to get the budget deal through, and they didn't want government to shut down. We were up against the clock in making this happen. And for many folks, as they started to pick away what was in the bill, recognizing what the tax breaks actually were in terms of the giveaway to big oil, the fact that this really wasn't going to do anything in terms of job creation, I think that there was a lot of buyer's remorse there in making that happen, and that the governor, rightly so, vetoed it because of those particular provisions. So, you know what? Let's this budget that has been negotiated. As a Democrat, I'm happy with some things that we're doing on the spending side. The revenue side is completely regressive. So let's not hold the capital budget hostage. Again, I think that's toddler behavior. Let's move on with this, and then let's just win the Senate back in 2018 for Democrats, and we can fix all of these.
Okay, before we take a break on this topic, Governor Inslee is now being talked about even more as a potential Democratic candidate for president in 2020 to take on Donald Trump. He will soon be at the helm of the Democratic Governors Association, which gives him a national profile. He will be traveling the country, being kind of the lead Democratic governor in the U.S., which certainly gives him a perch upon which to really make a bid if he wanted to. Dave Ross, what's your suspicion?
The thing to watch for is whether he decides to convene meetings in Manchester and Des Moines. If you see him saying, you know, it'd be a great idea to hold the governor's conference in Manchester.
New Hampshire.
Then I don't sense that this is a job he really wants. He's got a nice life there in Bainbridge Island. This would, of course, subject him and his family to nightmarish publicity and scrutiny. Not that he has anything to hide, but it's a huge sacrifice. I don't think he has a high enough national profile at this point, and I'm not sure that being head of the Democratic Governors Conference gives him that.
Tina, this is your party, your guy. Are you going to push for him to run in 2020?
Well, I think, you know, the last 10 years, the Democrats have not had the best track record in going out and winning these gubernatorial races around the state. And if there's one guy I think who can help us win, it's Jay Inslee, working for all of these different governors. So I think he's incredibly sincere about doing this particular piece of work. He's incredibly sincere about making sure there's a great majority for Democrats in Washington state. And I think he's on the job making all of that happen. I think speculating about presidential race, it's too early for anyone to be having those conversations.
As an observer, I say go for it. I'm in favor of anything that creates choices for voters.
Well, it opens up the governor's race as an open seat in 2020. For
he has written a book, right?
And he has.
Yes.
It's been a while.
Hollow's
Fire.
And the hint to look for is, in addition to what Dave said, is fundraising. So if Inslee looks like he's fundraising on a national basis, it means he's thinking about a presidential run.
Okay, another quick break. Coming up, Tim Iman is at it again another year, another initiative. Why this one could jeopardize your commute. The Week in Review is back in a moment. Okay, back now with the Week in Review. Joining me, Dave Ross from Cairo Radio, Tina Podlodowski, the chair of the Washington State Democrats, and Paul Guppy, vice president of the Washington Policy Institute, a conservative think tank here in the region. I'm C.R. Douglas with Q13 News. Bill Radke has the day off. Now, Tim Iman this week did what he loves to do, launch an initiative. It would cut the car tab tax down to a flat $30 across the state. One of Iman's early initiatives did just that, but over time, that cost has crept up as new fees have been put on car tabs, including last year's big $54 billion Sound Transit measure. Now, if this new initiative is approved, Sound Transit would actually lose a ton of its funding, jeopardizing light rail expansion.
Bring back our $30 car tabs and let's, you know, stick it to Sound Transit, because Sound Transit lied to us. They said how much these car tabs were going to cost, ended up being radically higher than anybody expected, and we're going to spend the next 6 months collecting signatures for an initiative that will get our car tabs back down to $30 the way the voters have voted for twice so far. This would be the third attempt.
So Iman is arguing that voters want a do-over when it comes to Sound Transit, that they didn't realize what they were getting in terms of that car tab tax hike. Paul Guppy, Where are you at? Is Iman onto something here?
Well, again, as a policy organization, it just gives us something to analyze, you know, and we've written studies on every one of Iman's initiatives about all the different moving parts. The interesting thing about Iman is that he is skilled at tapping into the public mood. He is sort of returning to his greatest hits, which is $30 car tabs. He has a very simple message. But this time around, he has something additional, and he alluded to it there in his soundbite, and that is that Sound Transit has a problem with public trust. So people got their car tabs in the mail, and it was sticker shock. And then people wonder, why is it that this has cost so much? And originally, Sound Transit talked about funding a $15 billion plan, and then that turns out to be $54 billion. So there's just various problems that Sound Transit is having with its public trust image. They overvalue people's cars so they can collect more money. That's another issue. And you add those together, and it allows a populist like Iman to have an opening to offer an idea like this. And I think he's trying to take advantage of that.
I mean, Dave Ross, he clearly wants to make this a referendum on Sound Transit.
Right. Well, he had one of those, and the voters voted for it. I've been a supporter of Sound Transit. I think if the city wants to grow, and I think it's clear from the number of cranes we've made that decision, there's no place to put more freeways. So if you want to continue that, you have to have a robust public transportation system. Sound Transit, though, does have this history of being tone deaf. The tabs were a big deal, and I think they should have known there was going to be this kind of shock. I think the fact that they went back to that old valuation system for cars, which was the big issue the first time around years ago and made Iman famous, to come back to that and give them that ammunition was kind of silly. On the other hand, what we learned from that previous initiative is that once you contract for the bonds, you can't undo the taxes behind them. So do you know if Sound Transit has already put out the bonds yet?
That's just to kind of give a little context here. Iman did try and do another $30 tab a few years ago, and it would have hit Sound Transit hard. That got litigated. The Supreme Court of the state threw that out for the reasons you say, which is once you've kind of issued bonds, there's a contract there between the bondholders and the state, and the revenue from that car tab was paying those bondholders. Voters can't undo that. That's a business contract.
So my guess is if Sound Contract hasn't already put out the bonds, they're going to do it really quick now to make sure this can't be.
I know Iman talks a little bit about how this initiative wouldn't fall into that same legal pit that somehow maybe some of the bonds aren't issued yet. So, Tina, voters, did they know? Did they not know what they were getting with Sound Transit and the car tabs?
I think you're going to have to ask voters that question, each and every one of them individually around that. But the issue really here is Tim Iman trying to find some way to keep himself relevant and make a buck. That's what this is about. I mean, what was particularly sad for me is, you know, when Tim Iman announced this initiative, the orange T-shirt that he was wearing was the same one he was wearing 2 years ago when he tried to do this and failed again, and the Supreme Court tossed it out. So I think for many folks, what we're seeing is Sound Transit working for folks, that there is no decrease in demand for mass transit, not just in the city of Seattle, but in the King County area, in the Tri-County area, and in fact, in places around the state of Washington. So I don't think that this is a place where Iman's going to get a heck of a lot of traction this time around either.
Paul Guppy, those of us in the media have kind of written his obituary, you know, 10 different times over the course of the last decade. He keeps persevering. Mm-hmm. In an impressive way. He is now facing, however, the biggest setback you could argue to his career, which is a $2 million lawsuit filed by the Attorney General for misusing campaign funds. He's obviously going to appeal that, and that has not been settled. But will his legal problems get in the way of his message?
They could if it develops. I will say, I mean, Iman is an entrepreneur. And that's actually something that I admire, that we have an open democracy and anybody can stand up and offer any idea and try to circulate their petition and get signatures. I think in general, that's a good thing. That we've had initiatives on the left and the right. And, you know, Iman is, he offers these tax cut initiatives, so he has a certain point of view. But as a private citizen, I think it's important to have a system in which literally anybody can stand up and say, I'm offering this idea. And that's what worries me about the lawsuit. I don't know whether there's merit to it or not, but when the campaign finance laws become so convoluted that it's hard for the average person to get engaged with the process, and, you know, Iman will deal with his own case, but I just mean in general, it sends a signal to most people, you know, you better not put your toe into the world of politics or you'll end up with the Attorney General of the state coming after you. And I think that's a result of so many complicated forms, reporting requirements, deadlines. I mean, as anybody who's run for public office knows, who knows when you've violated some PDC rule?
Well, let's talk about that, because the folks who keep perpetuating that, again, are the Republicans by not fully funding the PDC and for being able to work through the Public Disclosure Commission and to be able to work through that particular process so that things are easy and reportable. If you look at even the online reporting system for the PDC, it's incredibly difficult for folks to be able to do the work that they need to do. So let's fully fund that. But again, Tim Iman, I'm not crying for Tim Iman over this particular lawsuit. He's been taking money for a very long time to do this. It's not about people. It's about his shtick.
Okay, finally today, music. Now, from the city that gave birth to Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, and other grunge legends comes this new act, Grunge the Musical. Yes, you heard me. Grunge the Musical. The Seattle Rep just announced this week that it has commissioned that idea, a musical to be set in the early 1990s Seattle, when the grunge scene was taking off. It seems that there is no better place to workshop it than in the city of birth for the grunge movement. It was one of our gifts to the rest of the nation and the world in terms of music. Could be great, could be a flop. Dave Ross?
Well, I think the reason they're doing this is because Here Lies Love was such a fantastic production. I think still going on, right, at the Seattle Rep, which is set in the Manila Disco. Totally immersive experience.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
It's been received wildly in this town. It's a great experience. And I think they're trying to duplicate that in a way that no other city could.
Let me just play a little sound. This is from another musical performed here in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And see if this gives us any indication of whether a grunge musical can kind of compare
sure.
to the other great works that we have on stage here.
For all our politicians know just how to get elected, pretending not to care about the rich and well-connected. The beauty of it is that should the upper class get greedy, the money of the middle classes vanishes completely, completely, completely.
Yes. Yeah. That was from our production in the Seattle Gilbert and Sullivan Society of Utopium. Lyrics by yours truly. Actually, some of those were written, I believe, during intermission because we needed an encore. And
you didn't know that was coming.
No, I did not know that was coming. I didn't know that recording even existed in the public radio archives, but I'm very gratified that they got the exposure.
Tina Podlodowski, you were here in the 90s. Grunge, did it move you? Will this musical work?
Well, I'm a big fan of, you know, the grunge bands like Alice in Chains and Mother Love Bone and Soundgarden and a few others. It's going to be interesting to see, I think, from a Broadway theater perspective, probably the best show that took on rock and roll was Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And a lot of that was because you had a live band on stage. And it's going to be interesting to see what this treatment looks like. I'm going to withhold comment because who knew that a show like Hamilton, for example, would show up and we'd have hip hop and, our country's founders. So I'll withhold until I see.
Paul Geppi?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, is that the performance will depend entirely on the quality of the music. There's a lot of great rock and roll there, grunge music. The thing that I would be curious to see is what is the story context around that? Because unlike Hamilton, the grunge culture has a dark side and can be self-destructive. And
yeah, many of them have.
Hamilton had a dark side too, my
well,
friend.
Well, that's
yes,
true.
Yes, indeed.
I know
he was killed in a duel.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I mean, him as an individual. But what I meant is that grunge as a culture has
a drug dark side, exactly. I think is what you're saying.
But the music is something else.
That is a wrap for the Week in Review for Friday, July 14th. My thanks to Tina Podlodowski, Paul Guppy, and to the Gilbert and Sullivan stage performer,
yes.
Dave Ross. A great conversation today. The other all-star, Bill Radke, will be back next week. For all of us at KUOW, I'm C.R. Douglas. Thanks for listening.